Welcome to the Alpha Mind podcast with me, Stephen Goldstein, and my co-host, Mark Randall. Today, our guest on the podcast is Glenn Goodman, author of the book, The Crypto Trader.
What is it about trading that people think they know it all straight away, whereas with training to be a doctor or whatever, nobody goes, oh, yeah, I'm great at this surgery business. I haven't tried it yet, but I reckon I'm pretty bloody brilliant at open heart surgery. One time out of four or one time out of five where that strategy doesn't work and it just falls and falls. And it, particularly if you're leveraged, as a lot of people are in cryptocurrency trading, you get yourself to that point where your account is liquidated. Where the original use case for Bitcoin, the idea of it becoming a payment mechanism that everybody would use to buy their coffee or whatever, that's just not happened, has it? And anything that really matters to human beings has fundamental value. It's just very difficult to put a value on that value, if you see what I mean. You know, it's one thing to moan to your wife, oh, I've had a bad trading day, or even I've had a bad trading week. But try telling her day after day that you're having a bad trading year, and then the year after that, I'm having another bad trading year or whatever.
Before we start the podcast, a quick word about our sponsor, the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA, who are one of the world's leading bodies for the advancement of technical analysis education. They offer outstanding courses and diploma programs, both delivered at world-beating universities and academic institutions, as well as offered out through home study courses. We are delighted to be able to offer our listeners a discount on their home study course. We will tell you more about that later in this podcast. Now, without further ado, on with this week's podcast.
Well, welcome to this week's Alpha Mind podcast, and we're very lucky to have Glenn Goodman with us, author of a new book called The Crypto Trader. Glenn, very interesting story. He was an ITV news reporter who traded the markets for extra cash until one day he realized he was a successful trader who did TV reporting for extra cash. Some 20 years of collective experience of trading. And of course, in this world that we've chewed about several times on the Alpha Mind podcast, this world of cryptocurrencies. And, we're really keen to hear from Glenn about just what he's come across, who he's come across, the challenges of operating in the space. And of course, from his own evolution of becoming a trader, what he's learned on that journey, and perhaps, of course, you can always ask Steve and I for, what we feel might be useful for him in this constant evolution of him, becoming a better trader. So, Glenn, welcome. Welcome to the show, and good you're here. Perhaps give us a bit more background than I've shared there.
Thanks very much for inviting me on. Appreciate it. A bit of background. Okay, in a nutshell, I started trading during the dot-com boom and I messed up really badly and lost all my money. I was just a kid, a crazy kid. You know how it is? Well, you know how it is now because you've got all these Robin Hood traders doing pretty much exactly what I was doing 20 years ago. They get into it. They say, all you have to do is buy it when it's going up and then sell it when it stops going up. And if it like has a bit of a correction, you just buy the dip. You just keep buying that dip. That was pretty much what I learned in a nutshell from friends of mine 20 years ago. And we all were buying dot-com shares like crazy and it was all going fantastic. And we were doubling our money and doubling it again. And then the market suddenly crashed. But I got really scared and I got on the phone to my friend who worked for this company called Gameplay, which was a new pioneer in the new world of online gaming, which, of course, we know since then, online gaming's become massive. So, Gameplay, they were sure to become huge and succeed and take over the world, yeah? So when I phoned my friend and said, well, our shares are just halved in price. Like, we've just lost all our profits from the doubling. And he said, yeah, I know, it's brilliant, isn't it? It means we can buy even more at a cheaper price now. We can average down. I was like, yeah, that sounds like a really good idea. Reduce our average price. So I bought in. That was all great. And then about a couple of weeks later, I seem to remember the price just plummeted again. And I phone him up again and he's like, yeah, it's worrying, but I've spoken to the execs here and they say everything's looking really cool with gameplay. We've got a great future ahead of us. I'd even visited their headquarters. So I'd seen for myself, they had five stories in the center of London, like a major office building. And it was so sparse. There was hardly anybody in these cavernous warehouse type floors. But they had like arcade machines and all ping pong and all the cool stuff. So yeah, they were bound to succeed as far as I was concerned. So anyway, you know the story. I might as well cut to the chase. I kept buying and buying until they just fell to virtually nothing. In the end, I held on to them and put all my life savings, which at the time was about, I think, about £5,000. I wrote about this in my book. Might have been 10,000. I can't remember. It was to me now, a relatively small amount of money, but at the time it was everything. And I put it all in, and even when the price had fallen to virtually nothing, I was still, like all people in that position, just thinking, it doesn't matter. It's going to go up again one day. It might take years, but, you know, I'll make my money back one day. I'm prepared to stay for the long haul. I'm only 20, 21. And then what happened was the worst thing that could happen, which is a company decides to buy up gameplay for 1p per share, as opposed to £10 it had been at its peak. £10 to 1p. And yeah, so my shares were sold against my will for 1p each. And yeah, so I think I got about 30p out of it or something at the end, didn't I? That was pretty much the end of that.
Firstly, let me say welcome to the show.
Thanks.
I'm sure Mark's got things to say, but it's amazing how many of us, and I included, get introduced by something like penny shares. Now, I had a job as a bank trader, so you would think that would be my introduction. But it was really the middle 80s, when we first had companies going public, that kind of introduced me and a lot of my friends to it. You know, we had, you know, state firms like BT, BP, British Gas, all going public. Then we had the run of building societies going public. And then we got attracted to penny stocks. So I think, you know, and then they did really well and they were doubling and doubling and doubling. And then we had our event on October 1987, where it all happened in one day. The stock market and all the penny shares just ended pretty much there and then. And I remember, and some of my friends still talk about it, the very painful next day when they realised that everything they had and everything they made and everything they thought they had was no longer there. And everyone seems to have that. You know, you had it with the dot-coms. So that was kind of the next phase of it.
I don't know what I would have done in your situation. You'll have to explain to me what lessons you took from that. But for me, as I mentioned in the crypto trader, I learned a very valuable lesson that day, which changed my life, really. I did, because all my friends gave up from that moment on. None of my trading friends carried on after that, which is usually the way after these kind of washouts. But you always get a few like me who are determined to beat the system. You know, I've been beaten by it, but I'm gonna come back stronger. So I did the thing of reading all the books and reading all the articles and just trying to learn how it's done properly by the pros. And the main lesson I learned straight away was about cutting losses. You know, such a simple thing, and you know, probably the main message in my book and many other books. And yet it's the thing that gets ignored by practically all starter traders. Like I said, they all want to buy the dip and they have no plan whatsoever for getting out if that dip becomes a bigger dip and a bigger dip and a bigger dip. It just doesn't enter their minds because they've never encountered such a situation. When I finally encountered it, you know, I learned that lesson and it stood me in good stead ever since. And I like to say that money that I lost has been repaid 100-fold or so. I mean, I haven't actually worked out how much it's been repaid, but you know, you get the idea. It's paid for itself over and over again, that harsh baptism of fire that I had at the beginning. But 1987, I mean, that's a different kettle of fish altogether, because it wasn't, you couldn't even cut your losses because it happened so quickly, I guess.
Well, everyone was trading on phones. So, you know, no one was picking up phones. And that was the best you could have done. You couldn't even go on log on to something. You know, we really never had PCs even in those days. We had these. So, you know, that was what happened. No one picked up phones. But if I want to get back to you, obviously, you know, quick introduction to who you are. You told us about your first experiences. But then you've had an interesting career. You've left trading. It seems you've come back to it. You've got into crypto trading in a big way. Now you've written a book about crypto. So perhaps you could tell us and the audience a little bit more about that.
Okay, so what happened was I was working as a radio reporter for ITN, and I had my own show on LBC when I was far too young to have my own show on LBC. It was silly. I was like in my early 20s. And I mean, it was, to be fair, it was early every morning. It was at 5:30 a.m. It was called Dawn Traders.
Oh, my God, I listened to that.
Did you? You were probably thinking, yeah, oh, this guy, he's a presenter. He probably knows what he's talking about with trading. Not here's a 23-year-old kid who's literally just lost all his money and doesn't have the first clue.
I used to run the Middle East shift, and we need to get in. We had to be in work for 5:30. I think Dawn Traders at that time started at, I don't know, 4:45 or 5, wasn't it? Or 4, even maybe even 4:30. But there was some good insights, because I think you had some good guests actually were, you know, that there were, you know, the Asian commentary is something that came out of that. And I mean, but it was it's quite for those of us that are around then, it's quite an enigmatic show actually. So
I mean, you know, there were a bunch of presenters over the years besides me, so I don't know if you actually heard me, but I tried to. The thing is, what I should have done is just shut up and ask the old blokes questions, you know, the ones who came in the studio, the old hands, as you called them. I should have just asked them questions and listened to their wisdom. But no, when I watch these Robin Hood traders now, it's exactly the same. I was so arrogant. I thought I knew it all. What is it about trading that people think they know it all straight away, whereas with training to be a doctor or whatever, nobody goes, oh yeah, I'm great at this surgery business. I haven't tried it yet, and I've only heard about it, but I reckon I'm pretty bloody brilliant at open heart surgery.
There is this thing about trading, you only hear about the good trades, right? And you know, and they're always sort of amplified. It's a bit like the fisherman, you know, it suddenly turns from this bigger profit to that bigger profit. And of course, the ego gets in the way of you actually declaring that you made a horrendous loss, and actually modifying your process behind it, because we never own. We find that people are really reluctant to own up to the fact that they're wrong, which goes back to this sense of you know, cutting the trade out, just saying, well, I'm wrong, I'm out, you know, let's think again. And we appear to be almost sort of naturally quite reluctant to own up to that fact. If we were a lot more sort of guessed with it and fluid about making that decision, I'm sure we'd generally, as a collective, be trading a lot better by just owning up to the fact, yeah, I'm wrong, move on, next trade.
I mean, the problem is, you know, as I'm sure Stephen talks about with loads of his clients, it's just a fundamental human psychological issue that we try and avoid pain. I mean, you know, it's the most natural thing in the world to try and avoid pain. And if you can double up as the price falls and then double up again as it falls more, you know that, you know deep down that you're storing yourself up a possible huge amount of pain further down the line when it all goes tits up. But you're desperately hoping that by doing this process of doubling up and lowering your average price, you will eventually get back to that break even much more easily than you would have done if you hadn't doubled up, because you're lowering your average price. And then you will avoid that pain completely. And the harsh reality is that a lot of the time that's true. So a lot of the time, if you do that averaging down, doubling and doubling your holdings again as the price falls, a lot of the time you will be proved right. The price will rise again and you will avoid that pain. And so then it kind of reinforces itself in your head that that's a strategy that works, that not only stops you losing money, but also stops you having that horrible, horrible pain. But then, of course, there's that one time, it only takes, one time out of four or one time out of five where that strategy doesn't work and it just falls and falls. And it, particularly if you're leveraged, as a lot of people are in cryptocurrency trading, you get yourself to that point where your account is liquidated. Yeah. And it happens all the time, every day. I mean, the beautiful thing about crypto trading is that a lot of the data is public. And so you can see on the blockchain what's going on, and you can and the exchanges release a lot of data about liquidations. So you can see all these people being liquidated, accounts worth millions of dollars, and suddenly they're wiped out. All in one go. And it just happens over and over again, every day.
It's having a martingale strategy.
Yes.
That's what it is the concept of martingale. And I always tell people, you know, if your strategy is a martingale strategy or something very similar, stop. Stop now. Because it will end in tears. There is no question unless somehow you just decide to walk away and never do it again.
Yeah,
if you think about it, that just to remind people, if they're not familiar with martingale is a strategy of doubling up and doubling up and doubling up, used in casinos. You just stick it on red, and eventually it will come in red.
Yeah,
and you'll get your money back. So that's the idea of it. That's the concept. Of course, the reality is that the odds are against you, because there's more numbers than you've got a zero in there.
Even if it's a fair game and it's just red and black, even though it works in theory as an idea, the strategy, in real life we don't have infinite amounts of money, and there will come a time when you have a stretch of losses that just defies your worst nightmares and your worst fears, and you just get black, 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 black over and over again, and you never get to that red until you've lost all your money. And you can be sure as eggs is eggs that you will lose all of your money just on the bet, the one before it finally goes red.
The casino wants you to play a martingale strategy. Okay.
Yeah.
So you think about that. If you think of the markets as a casino and the market as the house, with the various parts of the house being the banks and the market makers, they want you to play that strategy because you will lose eventually and they'll win.
Yeah. So
that is the danger. So if you think about it in those terms, then you think, well, we've all done it, but why was I so stupid? You know, well, you're not stupid.
Yeah, you're just providing liquidity for the people that want to sell.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I keep digressing. I should go back to telling you very quickly my life story. So,
your story, Glenn.
My story by Glenn Goodman. I was a LBC radio presenter, but I was also a TV reporter at ITN at the same time, because LBC was owned by ITN in those days. And then I moved to the BBC. I was a business reporter there. So that's the thing. I kept trading throughout all of this. This was the period where I was reading all the books and learning how to trade and trying out various strategies, because also I was a business reporter. So I was immersed in this stuff every day anyway, whether I liked it or not. And then I'd go home and I'd read books. I remember a sort of older reporter friend of mine who wanted to get to know me saying, you know, apart from all this business and trading and everything, what are your hobbies in your spare time? And I thought about it. I went, I read trading books in my spare time. And he was like, right, okay. But that, for that period, that was my life. You know, well, my whole life wasn't just trading. I was hugely into music and in a band and all these kind of things when I was younger. But I just became obsessed with it for a period. As I say, I moved to the BBC and I did some business reporting there on Five Live and various other places. And then I moved back to ITN and I worked for London Tonight as a reporter, and I became their business correspondent. It's no longer called London Tonight. It's now called ITV London. And then I worked on the national news as a reporter as well. And, you know, did some big stories and interviewed lots of exciting people, sort of Leonardo DiCaprio and prime ministers, Boris Johnson, Theresa May, David Cameron. So it was a good, interesting job. I got to meet a lot of interesting people. But I was just too much into this whole trading thing. What can I tell you? I was just really into it. And you know, I hope none of my ex-bosses listen, because it did interfere with my work to some degree. There was a sort of classic episode where I had an epiphany and realized I cannot do this job and do trading both. And it was after the financial crash in 2009. I think it was about 2010, or it might have been late 2009. Do you remember those big riots near the Bank of England? So I was sent down to cover those, and I was kettled in with all the other, with all the protesters, and everybody was going crazy. And there were people right in front of me. They were smashing up the Royal Bank of Scotland. Do you remember that? They were smashing the windows of it. Well, I was standing right there, and I was being, you know, pushed and shoved backwards and forwards. Oh, you're the press, pushing and shoving me. Now, you would think this would be a great opportunity for an aspiring reporter to make a name for themselves. Did I care? No. I was on my phone, which was a BlackBerry at the time, and I was just obsessed with trading because the markets were also crashing that day for whatever reason, and probably to do with the financial crash. And I was just on my, and I just still can remember to this day the look on the face of my camera woman, who was just going, Glenn, what are you doing? You're saying, just get in front of the camera and talk to the camera. For heaven's sake, you're not supposed to be doing this. I was like, yeah. Okay, just 1 minute. I was like, get off, to the people who were shoving me, because they were messing. I was pressing the wrong button on my phone. The trades were going wrong. It was like, it was surreal, because I wasn't scared of the rioters who were threatening me. I didn't care at all. All I cared about was the numbers on my screen. So I had to make a decision. I can't do both of these things. And I chose the trading. I chose the thing that had got me in its grip, because the fact was that by that time, it was all going pretty spectacularly well most of the time. I'd had a real breakthrough with the financial crash, as it happens, because I was trading futures by that time, not just stocks and shares. I was doing spread betting and CFDs, and I had read enough that I thought I knew what I was doing, or at least better knew what I was doing. And throughout the whole of 2007, with the Northern Rock collapse and all the rest of it, people queuing outside the Northern Rock for their money, I was thinking how weird it was that the market was still rising, and it was still rising, and it was still rising. And I just thought, this is defying reality. But I knew from my bitter experience that the market can stay irrational longer than we can stay solvent, etc., as John Maynard Keynes is supposed to have said. And so I wasn't prepared to just be silly about it and do what the guys in The Big Short did, which was short it too early. But luckily, those guys in The Big Short, you know, came good in the end, obviously came very good in the end. But I do think that they were to some extent lucky. I didn't do that. I waited, but I had the point chart-wise where I knew the market was turning over, and I knew the point where I would consider a breakdown to be taking place. So I had my orders in the market. I was ready to go, and I didn't have to do anything more. And I remember the day, because it was a day when I had to go in a stunt plane for a TV report and do and be have a loop the loop done. I was the passenger, obviously. And I remember just before I got in the plane, I looked at my phone. I was like, this is looking suspiciously close to my breakdown point. Oh, what's going to happen here? Didn't want to get in the plane. Wanted to stare at my phone, but got in the plane, did the loop the loops and all the rest of it, which if you've never done that, you should give it a go. It takes your breath away, quite literally. And when I got out the plane, I looked at my phone and I was rich. Or sort of rich-ish. Anyway, the point was, the breakdown had occurred. The crash had begun. I had put stop sell orders in for not just the S&P 500, but also for the banking sector as an entire sector, and a bunch of individual banks as well. So I was short selling all the right things. And it was a dream come true. You know, I'd been trading, what, for eight years by that point. And this was sort of my big breakthrough. And I made a lot of money very quickly. I closed my shorts at a good time. Eventually, some weeks later, I think, or even months later in some cases, even though they banned short selling of banking shares at that time, it didn't matter for me because my shorts had already happened. They were already ongoing and I didn't have to close them until I was ready. There was just a ban on opening new shorts. And then some years later, the Times asked me to write a big feature story about it. So I think that's on my website still. You can read that if you're interested. But well, no, don't bother, because it just goes over what I just told you. You'll be wasting time. But anyway, that was kind of the big thing for me. And that's why a couple of years later in 2009, when I had that incident at the Royal Bank of Scotland, that's why I decided I think I can do this, because it wasn't just the shorting. In the couple of years after that, I'd continued to trade well. I was consistently making more money trading than I was from my job. And quite frankly, I just didn't want to go to work every morning. I didn't want to get up early. That was a big thing for me. I'm not a morning person, and it just sucked. And I hated the tube, and it was all sweaty. And I just wanted a break from that. So I worked out a deal with my bosses whereby I could just do a bit of freelancing, like 1 or 2 days a week for the national news, which was great, because it meant, you know, 1 or 2 days a week, I got to go in, interview the prime minister or whatever, and then go home and do trading the rest of the time. And I did that for several years, just kind of a little bit, keeping my hand in, until finally I just weaned myself off reporting altogether, started turning it all down, and just stuck to my guns with the trading. And then, if I can get to the end of the story, 2017 came along. I had already been trading cryptocurrencies for a few years. And in 2017, I'd set up a Facebook page talking about trading. It's called The Shares Guy. It's still called The Shares Guy, even though very quickly I realized all anybody wanted to hear about was Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. So that's what I talked about on that page. And it went a bit ballistic during the boom. I got about 250,000 followers on there at the time, which is still on there. And then I got asked to write this book, The Crypto Trader, largely because on my Facebook page, I called the top. I didn't do that stupid thing of saying, this is the top, everybody get out, because you never know. I'm not naive enough to think you know for sure whether it's the end of the market or end of the bull market or not. But I suspected it strongly. So, you know, you can still go back on Facebook. If you scroll back far enough, you'll find that warning. It says, you know, I can't be sure, something along the lines of, I can't be sure, but this is a warning. There's been parabolic growth in this here Bitcoin and the other cryptocurrencies, and I've drawn a big red line for the parabola, and now the parabola has been broken quite severely. I'm not selling my stuff right now. This was tail end of 2017, but I am thinking about it quite seriously. That was the gist of it. And then in the following days and weeks, I sold all my Bitcoin. I sold my Bitcoin before the end of 2017, and I sold my other cryptocurrencies because they kept some of them kept doing well for longer. They were the kind of stragglers that insisted on going up even when Bitcoin was going down. So I didn't sell them all immediately. I sold them over the next month or so. So by about January to February 2018, I was pretty much out of it, and everybody else was losing their shirts. So that's why the publishers asked me to write this book. So I could boast about that over the course of 250 pages. And that's it. That's my story.
Fantastic. Well, it's a huge story, and it's so relevant, I think, that dipping your toe into the market and staying with it and learning and, you know, building up the experience is obviously a critical start point, because so many people are put off just by bad process or just not bothering about the skills that are so significant. But I mean, if you look through your book, it's interesting, the scale of what's going on with this crypto stuff. You know, page 9, here are the prices of some of the major cryptos at the time of writing. Bitcoin, 5,138. It's now something like 30,000 odd. And Ethereum, 159. I think that's at 1,200 or something. And like even Litecoin, the sensible Litecoin has gone from $69 in the book to $120 or so at the moment. So, I mean, it is a bit bonkers. I mean, I think even when Paul Gordon was in one of the earlier podcasts this year, really educating us on crypto from his experience, I think it was probably around 10 or 12,000. And I remember at the time saying, "Yeah, this thing's going to 30,000 odd." And I think that if you had a product in the financial world and in the normal sort of polite world of markets that moved 300% in 6 months, you'd have risk people saying, don't get near it. You know, we can't model that. You know, how the hell do we manage risk when there's a 300% move in, you know, half a year?
As far as I can tell, anecdotally at least, the pension funds are still steering clear for exactly the reason you've just mentioned. But obviously the hedge funds don't care. They're piling in.
Glenn, can you, I mean, obviously there's a lot of our audience now are going to be people who trade crypto, but there's still a lot of people who don't want to go there or maybe nervous about it or just don't believe in it. How would you term the difference between trading crypto and trading other products like currencies, stocks? Or is it all the same? Is there no real difference anymore other than this insane volatility? But then we get that with Tesla and plenty of other stocks.
Well, I mean, the main difference from the perspective of somebody looking to decide what to trade in particular is the distinct lack of fundamentals in the world of cryptocurrencies. It's a real issue, and I think it accounts quite largely for the volatility. Because if you haven't got profits and revenues to hang your fundamental valuations on, then what have you got? And what we have got is sentiment. That's pretty much, this is a momentum-driven market, always has been. It's about network effects. The more people that are using Bitcoin, just to take the obvious example of Bitcoin, the more people that are using it, the more valuable it becomes. And the more valuable it becomes, the more people use it. So it's a self-perpetuating virtuous cycle, which again, I explain in the Crypto Trader how that cycle works. But likewise, when it's going down, it's a vicious circle going downwards and people use it less and less. And you see fewer and fewer transactions using it. I mean, here we are at a point in 2021 now where the original use case for Bitcoin, the idea of it becoming a payment mechanism that everybody would use to buy their coffee or whatever, that's just not happened, has it? Let's face it. It may still happen in the future. There are technologies that are still being developed, notably the Lightning Network and other things that are aimed at trying to make it usable for day-to-day transactions. But as things stand at the moment, it's just not happening that way. So instead, the narrative has shifted quite dramatically over the past year or so. It shifted to the central banks of the world are printing endless amounts of money. Therefore, the dollar is being devalued and other major currencies will lose value as well. And so we need to look for ways of keeping value, particularly if inflation starts rearing its head. We don't know if that's going to happen yet, but obviously there are fears of that. So where can we put our money? Well, the traditional thing to do is to buy gold. Yeah, but forget about gold, because now here's this cool new thing called Bitcoin, and it's the young people's gold. Young people don't care about gold. And then they say, yeah, but Bitcoin's not a real thing. It's just imaginary. And gold is a real thing, and it's really useful in the real world. And then the counter argument is, no, it's not. It's not useful at all. It's a piece of yellow metal. It's a load of rubbish. It's only fashionable because it's fashionable, just like Bitcoin's only fashionable because it's fashionable. And then obviously the counter argument is, yes, but gold has been fashionable for thousands of years, whereas Bitcoin's only been in existence for a decade. And you say, well, yeah, fair enough, but there's a new generation and they don't care about gold, and they understand the inherent value that there can be in invisible currencies. And the example that I used on a TV interview recently, I was interviewed a couple of weeks ago when Bitcoin was going through the roof by one of the cable networks, and they asked me about this. And I thought on the spot of an example, which is the game Roblox. I've got young kids and they play one of the most popular mobile games in the world, which is called Roblox. And what do they want for Christmas? They want Robux, the in-house currency of the game. To them, Robux is real money. It doesn't exist in real life. It only exists as numbers on their screen. But that's real enough for them because they can buy virtual outfits for their character in Roblox. You know, it's one of these immersive games where you walk around, a bit like Minecraft. So your character, you can see your character. You want to give them nice clothes. I mean, at the moment, my daughter, this is not going to happen for her. I can tell her this now. But she wants to spend approximately £170 of real money to buy enough Robux to get a wooden leg for her character. She's got a perfectly, it's got two perfectly good legs, this character. Nothing wrong with his legs. And I'm like, well, why do you want a wooden leg so that he has to like hobble around the whole time? And it's going to cost 170 quid. And she says, because then people will think I'm rich. Because it's a status symbol. It's like buying a Ferrari. She gets a wooden leg. And it means that everyone will go, oh, wow, she must have spent 170 quid on that wooden leg. She must be loaded. So you see how kids growing up now, to them, this stuff is meaningful. It really matters. And anything that really matters to human beings has fundamental value. It's just very difficult to put a value on that value.
I'd never thought about that, really. But this generation coming through now, and the young generations in their 20s, they were brought up in a crypto world. You know, crypto.
Yeah.
You know, they've all born with a PlayStation or an iPad, or it's natural to them. So really, gains currency, to use the expression. Money for those worlds gains, it has a currency of its own that our older generation, my older generation, and the generation above us, which struggle even more with this, just don't see. And it's fascinating. No. We're at this point in life where, you know, quite possibly this is the future. We will return to the podcast shortly. Firstly, a mention of the podcast sponsor, the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA, and their brilliant Home Study Course. The Home Study Course is the STA's proprietary e-learning course for students who wish to learn advanced knowledge on all aspects of technical analysis at their own pace or in their own geographical location, rather than in a classroom setting, which takes place at the world-renowned London School of Economics, and opens up a route to the STA diploma. Alumni of the STA diploma have been employed in many of the world's leading financial market organisations, including the likes of Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Deutsche Bank, UBS, Credit Suisse, Bloomberg, Dow Jones, Shell Trading, EDF Trading, as well as leading hedge funds and many other major companies and institutions. Listeners of the Alpha Mind podcast can obtain a £100 or local currency equivalent discount on the cost of the course by using a discount code exclusive to us at Alpha Mind. To find out more, go to the Alpha Mind blog page at alphamindblog.blogspot.com, or just search Alpha Mind Blog and go to the page link STA Home Study Course. Now back to the podcast.
Now, I think the way that money is going, and we found within the lockdown really that, you know, we're just not handling cash anymore. It's all kind of just like an e-transaction. And I think that's rather re-emphasized the shift away from physical stuff to essentially something that sits within the memory of your phone as a number. And we're just transacting numbers all of the time. And of course, from a crypto point of view, it becomes almost that, you know, your wallet is your hard drive. And of course, we're hearing all these stories about, you know, municipal dumps being dug up because some fella allegedly threw away his laptop with 7,000 bitcoins on.
I interviewed him for my book, actually, and he's been banging on about this now for 7 years. He wants it dug up and he's willing to pay the council millions of pounds if they're prepared to dig it up, but they just don't want to. It's a hassle that they're not prepared to undergo, even for the possible promise of millions of pounds. But yeah, the poor guy, it's, you know, the bane of his life. He can't get it out of his head, because the possibility of having these hundreds of millions of pounds that he would have if he could cash in these bitcoins is always tantalizingly close. You know, it's only a few miles from where he lives. It's right there and he needs it, and 7 years have gone by and the poor guy's still fretting about it. I feel bad for him.
No, but if you were reliant upon your hard drive to be your access to your fortune, I mean, one of my sons works for sort of part of Disney, and he had sort of multiple terabytes of information on this particular drive and it totally failed. I mean, it's a total drive failure. And there was a degree of backup and it took time for him to rebuild it. But crikey, if you were, you know, carrying around your sort of, you know, your Bitcoin value in essentially a dongle, one of those, you know, just on a device, piece of memory.
Yeah.
God, it would not feel comfortable if there was a lot of money on that.
No, I mean, the serious players take it very seriously, obviously. So you've got the Winklevoss twins, you know, the guys who helped set up Facebook. Well, helped set up Facebook. They reckon they invented it, didn't they? And then they sued Mark Zuckerberg, I think. I can't remember the details, but anyway. So don't sue me, Winklevoss twins, if I just got those facts wrong. But anyway, point is, they became early pioneers and bought a lot of Bitcoin. They own something in the billions, I think, of dollars worth of Bitcoins. So apparently the way that they do it is the important thing, you see, is not the Bitcoins themselves or the piece of equipment that you keep them on. The important thing is the private keys, which are a kind of password, right? So it's just a long string of characters and numbers and letters. And that's what you've got to keep safe. The private key. So what they have apparently done is split the, you know, written it down on a piece of paper, the private key, literally on a piece of paper. This is how I understand it. Sorry, Winklevoss twins, if I've got you wrong, but this is what I've been told. So they write it down on a piece of paper, and then they cut the piece of paper up into several different pieces and send each piece to a safe deposit box in a bank vault in a different part of the United States. So that even a bank robber wouldn't be able to get their hands on their money, because they'd have to rob all the different banks simultaneously, which ain't going to happen.
Oh my God, you can imagine
that. That would be, it'd be a great film, actually, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and that's the challenge. You know, I think I look at it and just think, you know, what typical currency, exchanging value for goods and services. And you just think, you know, calling it a currency of any kind is actually accurate. I mean, I'm just not sure. At some point, I suppose it could well turn into something that we...
Well, some people call it an asset. They call them crypto assets. A lot of the people in the industry call them crypto assets rather than cryptocurrencies, because they feel that, particularly for quite a lot of these things, they don't really resemble currencies much. Mm. You know, a lot of cryptocurrencies are absolutely... are very, very little to do with finance. A lot of them are invented for more prosaic purposes, making various IT projects work better, that kind of thing. Or dApps is a common word used, is a kind of app. They call them dApps. They sit on blockchains like the Ethereum blockchain, and they are basically, you know, pieces of software that do all kinds of different things, solve various real world problems, and they often have a kind of currency element built within them because they are cryptocurrencies, but the currency bit is kind of irrelevant. It's hard to explain in a short space of time, but I could I could fill you in greater detail at some point. But, you know, you get the general idea. The point is that some people call them crypto assets because a lot of them aren't much to do with the world of currency. They do other stuff instead. Bitcoin, however, was invented to be a currency and is supposed to be a currency. But as we've already talked about, as of this year, or last year rather, the narrative has changed somewhat. And now it's being called digital gold. And so it's being treated more as an asset than a currency. I mean, we could argue about whether gold is a currency rather than an asset as well. But I would class it more as an asset that goes up and down wildly in value rather than a currency that anybody actually wants to spend on stuff. Because by the time you've got hold of your Bitcoin, it could be wildly different in value to what you thought it would be. And you were about to buy your coffee with it, and suddenly your coffee costs £10.50 instead of £1.30 because the price of Bitcoin has changed so dramatically in a short space of time. I mean, look, nobody's using it as a currency. Very few people compared to you look at the blockchain itself, you look at the transactions, nearly all the transactions are for speculative purposes. Let's not kid ourselves otherwise.
Yeah.
So I trade it. And that's why I got into trading cryptos quite early on, because they were there. They were sitting there waiting to be traded.
I want to know, with regard to your trading, so what drives your trading? Tell us a bit about what gets you into a trade. What's the thing that creates your signals? How are you managing your trades? Can you share some of that?
Yeah, I mean, traditionally I was very much a trend follower for many years. I loved the writings of people like Ed Sakota, in particular, who was sort of Well, I'd like to think he was a bit of a mentor because, like many people, I used to write to him and he used to write back and give advice and things, and it was great. The guy's a genius as far as I'm concerned. So I kind of got tutored in trend following from him. But, you know, like many people, I've tried many different styles of trading over the years, fundamental stock analysis and, you know, not just momentum-based trading. Over the years, my trading style continues to evolve somewhat, and I'd say it's a lot more chart-based and chart pattern-based than it used to be. I used to try to be a pure trend follower, using things like moving averages, moving average crossovers to get in and out of trades. But I found it emotionally draining, I think, after a time, because you get those strings of losses, particularly if you're a long-term trend follower like I was, and you'd have great years, like 2009 being a great year for me, and then you might have like 2 or 3 years where you virtually earn nothing at all. And particularly when I'd gone full-time and was just sitting at home with my wife, just moaning to my wife. You know, it's one thing to moan to your wife, oh, I've had a bad trading day, or even I've had a bad trading week. But try telling her day after day that you're having a bad trading year, and then the year after that, I'm having another bad trading year or whatever. I mean, I can't remember which years were the bad. I think it was 2010 a bad one. I can't remember. There were some great years too, but, you know, those long periods, those long, long drawdowns just got a bit much for me. So I started getting more into sort of medium term, I suppose what you'd call medium term trading, and a little bit of, when you use chart patterns, then you're a little bit more of a swing trader as well. You know, you're not necessarily waiting for a trend to fully establish itself before you jump on, because you might see a pattern forming quite near the bottom. So you're still missing the tops and the bottoms. Just like with trend following, I still don't try and get the tops and the bottoms. I'm still trying to get that big chunk in the middle of each trend, just like I was before. But I suppose my methods of entry and exit have changed. I pay a lot more attention to things like money management, risk management, psychology, all of that kind of thing than I used to. And I wrote chapters about them in my book, chapters that people hardly ever mention. When they write to me, people write to me all the time, which is really nice. It sort of gives me a reason for living, that when I'm feeling miserable, I'll get an email. Yeah, I get emails every day, and they're nearly always very, very nice and just saying, you've changed my life. I'm rich now. All thanks to you, or words to that effect, or at least, you know, I'm heading that way, is usually more the gist of the emails. And the thing is, that I can't remember why I mentioned that. Why did I mention that? Because I've lost my train of thought. What was I saying?
The question Mark asked was how you trade.
Oh, yes, how I trade, yeah.
I'm really curious because, I mean, that question leads into something which I made a note about earlier on, where you talked about 2007 and you finally made money when you're sitting in the middle of a crowd of anti-capitalist demonstrators, which must be the unique, the uniquest approach to making money. But that must have been about a 7 or 8 year journey from when you started doing the penny shares. And a lot of people, they're listening to you today and they must be thinking, wow, you're living the dream. You know, this is what they all want. But they're in that early 1, 2, 3rd year. And then thinking, when does this change? When do I start making money? And I think your journey is quite normal. You know, that 7 or 8 year period, it's very common for many people.
I was earning a nice little second income, but it wasn't a life changer. So it kept me going for those 7, 8 years while I was learning everything there was to know.
That was the point I was trying to get to. A lot of people just give it up and put their full-time profession into trading when actually you had an alternative income and you had a number one income. And this is where a lot of people make a mistake. You know, I just feel I'm going to put my money on the line. I'm going to trade for a year. And if I've made it after a year, but I just don't think you can make income earning money in those early years. You need either another income, you need some money behind you, or you need somebody who's going to support you, a wife, a family, a rich parent, if you've got them. It's very rare to make money, that sort of money you can live on from day one, not impossible, but almost impossible.
I agree. And the pressure is too great more than anything else. Getting onto the sort of the emotional side of things. I mean, everybody's different. Some people handle it better than others. But the idea for me of right at the beginning, having, you know, with a small amount of money or whatever savings I had from my jobs, just giving up my job and just sitting there and trading for a year and hoping for the best without any track record behind me, that I don't think I would have been able to trade very well, because the whole point is I only gave up my job when I felt confident that I'd had enough years where I was doing well and increasingly well as well. So it, you know, then I had that confidence when I started doing it full time that hopefully I could pull this off if I followed a million different good trading rules and didn't sort of mess them up too often, then hopefully I'll be okay. There was a beautiful tweet that you did just this morning, Stephen, that is particularly pertinent, where you say a common feature I observe amongst traders is trading well after suffering drawdowns, but poorly when ahead. And I felt that was so true, even for me today. It was certainly very true of me when I was younger. But even now, I struggle with that all the time. When I have a bad period of trading, it sort of centers me and humbles me. And I get back down to brass tacks and I trade, you know, perfectly, even with a much reduced account sometimes in the past. I get there and suddenly I'm building it up. And I think, yeah, look at me. You know, okay, so I messed up, but now I'm coming back. And I'm doing everything right. I think I've conquered my demons. And then you start making loads of money. And then you go, oh, I've done more than conquer my demons. I'm actually now probably the best trader in the world. This is great. And then it's at that moment when you start messing everything up. You start thinking, even if you don't think it consciously, you still think consciously, well, I'm still going to be sensible and follow my rules. But there's something in the back of your head that makes you stop following your best rules, even without you almost noticing it. Do you know what I mean? It just kind of creeps up on you.
There's a very famous market saying, I'm sure you've heard of it, which is always leave a little bit on the table for the next person. And the idea of that is this concept of humbling yourself and grounding yourself and not trying to go for the whole lot. And we did a podcast last week where we did our best insights and wisdoms for the new year.
I agree.
And Mark mentioned this idea of, you know, 80% can be enough. Take your profit 80% of the way towards your target.
I think that, you know, taking 80% out at 80% of the position out at 80% of the target is just sensible, but also waiting around for the 100% tires up your mental state into just this clutter of, you know, dreaming the market gets to your 100%. I think it gets really, really bad practice. And of course, the other thing that I think also ties into this is at a certain point, you start to go shopping in your mind about you're making all this money. And if I carry on making all this money, you're adding to your Lambo collection, you're adding to your islands, and you start to not look at the market. So actually, when you're humble, you become a lot more focused about, you know, trying to get yourself out of that sort of maybe a doldrum.
And crucially, you tend to be much more focused on cutting losses, because when it's your, you know, there is a big difference, isn't there? And I think this was in your tweet about the the precious earned money and the less precious windfall money. And it's sort of when you're playing with house money, it just doesn't feel as important or as real. And, you know, as I say, I got to confess, I even start falling into that trap. I started to fall into it very recently, like as in the past few days. You know, you'd think after 20 years I'd have bloody learned my lessons, but oh no, you know, because I've earned so much money crypto trading recently, and you know, when a market's in a raging bull like that and you're trading it, money just kind of comes at you. You have to almost fight it off. It's, you know, and you start to feel like, oh my god, I'm so good at this. And then again, I started thinking that, even though I should know better, I started thinking I'm so good at this. But then I noticed that a lot of novice traders who have read my book were writing to me going, thanks so much for your advice. I can't stop making money now.
And I thought, oh, hang on. You know, it's not my great experience that's making me all this money. It's the fact we're in a raging bull market and even the novices are making tons of money. And but because I'd made so much, I started getting more lax with my stop losses and starting to override them sometimes and be like, oh, it'd be all right. What's £1,000 between friends? You know, it's like, what's the big deal? You know, this money is neither here nor there to me. Whereas when I've suffered a terrible drawdown lasting weeks, months, or even years, then I'm so careful with every penny and every penny counts. And that's how you start sort of building up your money better. Actually, there's a great quote. You reminded me from what you were just saying, Mark, reminded me of a great quote. So I just quickly Googled it. It was Jesse Livermore saying, one of the most helpful things that anybody can learn is to give up trying to catch the last eighth or the first eighth. These two are the most expensive eighths in the world. Obviously, he's talking about a time when people still counted shares in eighths of a dollar. But yeah, so he was prepared to give up. What's that? A quarter of the entire move. Those are the expensive bits. So that's 12.5% only at the beginning and 12.5% at the end, I suppose.
Yeah, but I mean, it is so true, and it's human nature. And, you know, I think that's what it's almost part of the great performers at every level in everything, not just sport, but in, you know, art, music. You see them maintaining their level of performance whatever happens. You know, you look at the great footballers, Ronaldo and Messi, they keep being able to do it week after week, year after year. They don't just stop when they get to the top. And there's something that I met with many of the best traders I've worked with over the years. They somehow are humbled. You know, they stay humble and they don't get caught in this kind of godlike, you know, ability to make money. It's because I'm a genius and therefore I don't need to be disciplined and structured and, you know, and do the background stuff. I always remember listening to one of my favorite podcasts. You've probably heard the Chat with Traders podcast over the years. They did a great one with Trader Dante, Tom. And he told a story of when he was working as a prop trader. And they had a lot of great traders at this firm. And there was one guy who made more money than anyone else. And he was telling the story. There was a day where this guy had a big six-figure day. And Tom had left the office to go home, had a drink after work, got home, realised he'd left his keys in the office and he couldn't get in. And he went back to the office about 7 or 8 o'clock at night to get his keys. And there was one light left on in the office. And it was this trader. And he was doing his after day review. And you're thinking about, and he goes, and that's what made him such a great trader. I assumed he was going to be out down a bar, swigging champagne or beer or whatever you do when you've made that amount of money. He said, this guy was doing that stuff that we should all be doing.
It's interesting. There was a tweet that I think you did months ago that I've remembered. I think it was you, but it was about how, I haven't got it in front of me, but from memory, I think it was how all the best traders make all the same mistakes that beginner traders make. They just make them less often.
Yes, that was the one, yes.
Was that classic, yeah, Goldstein?
That was one of my tweets, yes. And it is something I noticed, again, from working with all these great traders, that they have the same fears, the same anxieties, the same nervousness, the same drawdowns, they make the same bad errors. Everyone thinks they're kind of perfect. No, like watching a great sportsman, you know, Federer misses an easy smash sometimes.
Yeah.
Djokovic misses an easy backhand down the line. They all make, you know, Nadal with double fault. They all make the same mistakes that we make. They just do them less often. And also they get back on the train much quicker. You know, it doesn't fluster them. You know, if you watch, and I love watching tennis as an example, or boxing. Boxing is a great one as well. You know, they just have their mind more on it. You know, we did a great interview last year with Damien Hughes. So we had Damien Hughes on, who's a sports coach, and he's worked with Barcelona and Man United and lots of Olympic champions. And he was telling us of a particular example with someone he worked with. Oh, no, it was a boxer. He was talking about a recent world title fight. And I think he was talking about Tyson Fury.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and he was saying about Tyson Fury stays down for the full 8 count when he goes down, which isn't very often. Okay. And he says a lot of boxers make the mistake of springing straight up because they want to show the world that they're not hurt.
Right.
And he said, that's the very worst thing you could do. He said, you take the full count, you get out of your system, you get a time for, chance for you to recover a little bit and think about how you're going to step back into the fight. And he said, so many people make these ego mistakes. So he said, a boxer who springs up to his feet after 2 seconds is still shaken. And he's then going to get pummeled straight away by the other guy who's going to launch into him.
It's interesting because I think of Tyson Fury as a really arrogant guy. That's how I perceive him. And yet when it comes to his craft, I guess he's able to put all ego aside and just do what needs to be done and not try and impress people. It's all about just focusing on your knitting, I suppose.
It's ring craft. I mean, they talk about it in boxing as ring craft. And this, for me, is kind of wrist craft. Mm. You know, you see it with traders.
Yeah, exactly. It's the effectiveness of energy preservation. You know, you can waste an awful lot of time in a trading room just staring at your screen looking for something that's not there. And yet, if you can relax your gaze slightly and actually do other things and don't spend the entire day looking, then it's much easier to see and have clarity around what a trade idea as it evolves than if you were, just smothered in distraction. And I think with the performance world and the sports world, energy preservation, the ability to bounce back, still keep clarity to the way you behave when you're, in whatever a high performance sport you're in, I think energy is the determinant as to just how well you perform. And I think very much in the skill set of the great Zidane, from a football point of view, chose his moments to suddenly wake up and be active and be fully committed with a huge amount of energy rather than dancing around the field, chasing every ball, which is the, you look at any amateur football game and everyone comes off at halftime needing a stretcher because they've chased every moment. But the professionals choose their moment very carefully.
I'm very conscious of the time. Where can people find out more about you and your book as well? Just quickly tell us about the book a little bit more in more detail.
Okay, so the book is a full beginner's guide, really, to trading cryptocurrencies. So it's not all about the in-depth technology behind it, though I do talk about that in the first couple of chapters, give people an introduction so they understand what it is that they're dealing with and how these cryptocurrencies actually work. But primarily it's a trading book. It's how you make money out of this stuff, right? And how I make money out of it is not by doing the thing that people do called hodling. Right. Hodling is the word that's been going around in crypto circles for years now. It came originally from an internet chat room where somebody said, I'm going to hold forever, except they misspelled hold and wrote HODL, hodl. And then somebody decided that was quite a good acronym for hold on for dear life, hodl. And that's basically the philosophy that most cryptocurrency people have. People inside the kind of the world on crypto Twitter, the people who are obsessed with it, the people who have a picture of Bitcoin as their profile picture. You've seen these people. There are many, many of them, thousands and thousands of them. And the thing is, their philosophy has to some degree been vindicated so far, right? In the sense that cryptocurrencies, okay, they have terrible, terrible drawdowns of 80, 90% or more. But then they come back and they go even higher. This has been happening now for a decade. They've been going higher and higher. So you can't write this off as a tulip bubble because it keeps rebubbling, right? So if it is a tulip bubble, it's a very unique kind of tulip bubble that just every time it crashes, it doesn't wait a century or even 10 years to recover. It only waits a couple of years. And then before you know it, it's back to even higher heights. So there is something in that hodling so far. But I take a longer view. And the way I see it,
every bubble, even a super bubble like this one, has got to come to a sticky end at some point, and it's going to be nasty. And what's more, even if we just keep having this cycle where every time it has a massive drawdown, it then comes back even higher, even if you accept that that's going to keep happening, it still makes sense not to hodl, because what I do is I catch that big chunk in between each time. So, you know, that's what I did in 2016, 2017. I captured a big chunk of the market, sold out near the top, you know, after I'd seen the first signs that the parabola being broken and various other things that told me this is probably the bull market ending. Not definitely, but probably. So I got out of my positions, and then I avoided what for Bitcoin was an 85% fall in price, and for many other cryptocurrencies was 95% or more. Some of them never recovered, of course, but many of them have done on the coattails of Bitcoin recently. So my book is really about, you know, traditional trading techniques, classical trading, classical charting. I you know, reference Schabacher and the other greats, or, you know, the first people who wrote those books in the 20s and the 30s, McGee as well, and Jesse Livermore I talk about a lot because he's a hero of mine. I know you have a complicated relationship with him, Stephen.
No, I think he is a hero of mine. I think he's brilliant. However, there are questions about him as well. So some people say, I mean, what he did was phenomenal, but he couldn't hold on to it. If you end up losing it as well, you know, trading is about just an upward path and growing your wealth and keeping it.
Yeah.
And he made all his money.
Yeah.
And then he lost it all.
I think he had a lot. He gave us most of the wisdom that all three of us believe in today, as far as trading goes, or a lot of it anyway. But at the same time, because he was so ignorant of risk management, money management, that hadn't been really, you know, that area of trading hadn't been fully explored in those days, and I guess there weren't good books about it and all the rest of it. So he kept making that error over and over again, which is why he, you know, right from the beginning, he had that nickname Boy Plunger, because that's how he made his fortunes, was by going all in, being a pig every time with a trade that he believed in. But, you know, which is all well and good if you can manage your losses and cut them. And certainly he did believe in cutting losses. That was part of his philosophy. But, you know, like so many traders who don't have a properly worked out plan, it's all very well saying I believe in cutting losses. But when it comes to the crunch, he clearly wasn't doing it, because he was losing everything over and over and over again.
When you're good, you're good. And when you're bad, you're dreadful. And he was kind of one of those a little bit. And now that becomes a question. Does that, you know, if I was to know someone who made 20 years of profits and then lost it all in one day, does that make them a good trader? Or does it make them a good trader for 20 years and then one big failure at the end?
I guess you could say his life was a failure, because not only did he end up killing himself in a hotel lobby, shooting himself, but also he left a pretty bad legacy in terms of his family, who were messed up. His son ended up committing suicide, I understand, you know, because he was always absent from the family, or there were various family problems connected with having lots of wealth and then not having any money and then having lots of wealth. You know, I mean, it screwed up everybody, what he was doing. It's a bit like one of those things where he's a hero because for one bright, shining moment, he was amazing, you know. You know, it's like Maradona or something. Whilst I might think Maradona, most of his life was pretty crappy, and a lot of the things that he said and did were pretty crappy, there were still a few sort of bright, shining moments that make him forever a hero.
Listen, Mark, do you want to do a quick wrap-up?
Absolutely. And just for Glenn's benefit, this leads into a and finally moment. So, and finally, I mean, I would suggest people read this book. I think I've read quite a bit of it, and I do like it's just an honest recap of the things that are super important to know, that if you're starting to, you know, build a vocation in the world of trading to potentially become a career in trading. And you know, I think there's lots of value you share. I think the community should be very grateful for that. But, you know, and finally, really the case of when volatility increases, make sure your risk management increases with it. Make sure your processes, you know, are rock solid and you don't lose sight of them. And really just learn to step away. You know, markets do change direction every now and then. They've gone from, you know, a relatively low level to 300% of that level in a very short amount of time. So one needs to treat it with a degree of caution. But having best process in the background and best practice around what you're looking at to determine a change of sentiment, ideally ahead of the game, noticing that. But, you know, if you've not got process around technical analysis, then, of course, we certainly encourage that. And with our sponsor being the STA, we do suggest some of their courses as being a great foundation for this work. So I suppose the last and finally of this is, you know, if you get involved in trading this stuff, just keep a close sight of where your passwords are.
Yeah, and just follow all the main trading rules that are in my book, The Crypto Trader, but are also in, you know, most of those rules apply to other markets as I've seen. Some of, you know, I try to sort of make it specific to crypto, but a lot of it applies generally to whatever you're trading. You follow those trading rules, the tried and tested rules, and you will make money in cryptocurrency without then losing it all again. It's pretty much that simple. It's the not losing it all again that my book is really all about.
Great. And if people want to follow you, they can follow you in Facebook, yeah, under The Shares Guy.
And on Twitter, at Glenn Goodman is where I sort of tweet my thoughts on Bitcoin from time to time. And soon I'm going to expand my empire. I want to start up a video channel soon. It's something I've been meaning to do for quite a while with my telly background and my various bits of expertise from my telly background. It seems a shame not to be doing video at the moment. So I'm going to set that up soon.
Well, brilliant. Listen, thank you so much. We'll put all those details of how to follow you on our website and the episode webpage.
Yeah, thanks very much. It's been good fun.
Thank you to the STA for sponsoring today's podcast. Do check out their services at technicalanalysts.com. If you have enjoyed our podcast, you can sign up for our newsletter, details of which are on our Alpha Mind blog at alphamindblog.blogspot.com. We would also be delighted if you go onto iTunes, Spotify, or whichever podcast service you use and give us a rating and even better, a review. That helps others to find out about the Alpha Mind podcast. If you're keen to know more about the performance coaching and mindset coaching services we offer at Alpha Mind, you can do so by going to my website, alpharcubed.com. That's the letter R in between the words alpha and cubed. And on Mark Randall's website, markrandallconsultancy.com. Or just email info@alpharcubed.com. Our coaching programs and services are delivered to many top trading and investment organizations around the world, as well as to professional traders inside organizations and to professional retail traders. Finally, do follow us on social media. Our Twitter handles are at AlphaMind101 and at AlphaMind102, or go to connect with us on LinkedIn or join our AlphaMind LinkedIn group. Please also do check out our blog page more fully. There we have periodical articles, as well as pages of resources on books for traders, lists of other podcasts for traders, and details of our growing YouTube channel. We wish you all a great and safe week ahead. Thank you.